Hello and welcome to BizNews Radio. You're listening to the Editor's Desk with me, Felicity Duncan, and with BizNews editor Jackie Cameron. The big story this week, Jackie, had to do with business interruption insurance, which sounds like a pretty boring topic, but in the light of the COVID-19 outbreaks, it has become something of a hot potato. A lot of South African businesses making insurance claims that have been rejected, claims related to COVID-19 interruptions. Do you want to explain to us a little bit about what's going on in case people haven't been following the story?
Yes, sure thing, Felicity. Well, business interruption is a type of insurance that businesses take out so that if something goes wrong and they're unable to operate, the idea is that the insurer will pay for their lost revenue. And what's happened with COVID-19 is insurers in South Africa and also elsewhere in the world have been refusing to pay these claims. They've refused these claims for a number of reasons, ranging from an argument that COVID-19 hasn't stopped their business, but government containment measures have. So therefore, the insurance claim falls outside the scope of the pandemic. And then as we've been hearing from insurance experts, insurance companies have also been using delay tactics to get out of paying smaller businesses for claims that really do seem to be valid. And so this has really put a lot of businesses under severe strain, and some have also gone under because obviously they haven't been able to recoup their losses. And so a legal battle has been brewing. And this week, one small company won a legal victory against insurer Guardrisk, and Guardrisk was ordered to pay Cafe Chameleon, ordered to pay them out for their business claim. And then later on in the week, Santam said that it would not pay out and it was still sticking to its guns, so much so that on BizNews we said that Santam should get the Darwin Award if there was such an award for a corporate. And then on Friday, there was a new development with the Financial Services Conduct Authority issuing a statement saying that businesses have no grounds to not pay out claims. And so they've made this ruling and they've said that they're going to take action against insurers who are not paying out for business insurance. There's been a change in the law in South Africa in recent years, which makes it much harder for insurance companies to hide behind fine print. So the Financial Services Conduct Authority says that because these businesses bought the insurance, it's unfair for them to now not get the payout because there's something in the fine print or there's an unfair proof of claims. So that's been the major development. So the Santam share price dropped a little bit this week before the release of the Financial Services Conduct Authority statement on Thursday. So it will be very interesting to see how it plays out in its share price this week.
It's a really interesting case because to me, it comes down to a very central thing, which is how are we going to distribute the costs of the pandemic? So everyone has been affected, all businesses have been affected. And now it's a question of, well, how do we make sure that the costs of this are borne in a fair way? And it was interesting. I was talking to my partner who used to be an insurance lawyer in the United States. And in the US, the basic principle in adjudicating insurance cases is there is a strong preference to find claims insurable. So if there's a question, then judges are expected to find in favor of the covered person, the policyholder, the claimant, and against the insurance company. Because insurance companies, you know, have huge legal teams, and really the balance of power between a policyholder and an insurance company is not very fair. The insurance company has access to a lot more knowledge and a lot more legal expertise than any given small business that's getting cover. And so the general rule is, if it seems like a claim can be interpreted in one of two ways, it is generally interpreted in favor of the policyholder. And it sounds to me like that is the position that the Financial Services Conduct Authority and the courts are starting to take in South Africa, to say, obviously, when businesses bought this, they were thinking about interruptions caused by notifiable illnesses. COVID is a notifiable illness. The interruption was caused by COVID. Therefore, they were in good faith assuming that they were covered for this. And so, you know, it's legitimate for the insurance companies to pay. And I think that's a completely fair ruling. And what the insurance companies were saying was that this is not the proximal cause, right? This is an axial cause. So it's not the immediate cause. of the interruption. The, it sort of goes COVID government business instead of COVID business. But that, that has not stood up very well historically in a lot of different countries in the court systems, when the sort of ultimate claim is really, or the ultimate cause is what's at stake. And I'd be very surprised if government doesn't end up coming down on the side of business, because it's a lot easier to rescue one insurance company than it is to rebuild an entire economy of small businesses. So from a social perspective, from a social interest perspective, it seems to me that the right call is to let the insurance companies pay and deal with the fallout of that later.
All excellent points, Felicity. And just for people who are listening to this podcast, it's, if you're interested in this topic, Felicity has done a very interesting column, which is published in BizNews Premium on this whole insurance topic. And then Felicity, another point that is worth noting on this issue is that there is one company in South Africa, OUTsurance, which has paid from the get-go. So it's quite interesting that it's gained a lot of support from customers. So it's obviously been quite a good move in terms of building their reputation, but it also showing people that they're doing business in an ethical way.
Yeah, very interesting. And certainly you can imagine OUTsurance picking up a lot of business out of this when companies see the client-centeredness of them compared to perhaps the self-centeredness of some of the other big insurance companies. So you're right, a sort of a long-term reputational impact here might also be at play. I recall that sometime in the interview that they had with Alec, they were saying that they have more business interruption insurance than OUTsurance, and therefore it's, you know, there's more at stake for them. But surely that just means that a bigger slice of their portfolio is at stake, and that they would have every interest to service those clients well, especially given how the decisions are coming down. So it will be interesting to see how Santam reacts to the latest news from the FSCA.
Very interesting. And now another big story that we've been running on biznews.com, and of course, as has everybody, is the ongoing COVID-19 containment and how the whole pandemic is unfolding in South Africa. And we've seen a bit of an uptick in numbers, particularly in Gauteng, which has now overtaken the Western Cape as the epicenter of the pandemic in South Africa. Although the Western Cape has still registered more deaths. And then we've carried some very interesting interviews on biznews.com, not just about the deaths, but the after effects of COVID-19, which are not as well covered. And we had a very interesting interview with Dr. Joe Barnes, who points out that many people are not dying of COVID, but they're also not recovering from it. And she says that many of us will actually never fully recover and could be seriously impaired by the virus.
It's very striking because we have we haven't for such a long time as a society, we've been sort of spared the impact of these plagues, right, or these very widespread virulent infectious diseases. So we're not kind of used to the broad impacts they can have. And reading about, I've read a number of accounts of people who had COVID perhaps back in March or April, as early as that, and have continue to experience a very wide range of primarily neurological symptoms. So, for example, fatigue, some confusion, difficulty concentrating, symptoms like loss of smell and taste are also persisting, which a lot of neurologists say indicates that there's been some type of permanent damage to the nervous system. Although they obviously, you know, it's early days and we don't fully understand what it is. And it just makes you think about the, you know, we are rightly relieved that the mortality rate from COVID seems to be relatively low compared to, you know, our worst fears or compared to what we see in horrifying pandemic movies. And that's obviously a good thing. But for people who struggle with these long-term persistent symptoms, I mean, that's a huge human cost as well as a huge social and economic cost, because a lot of people struggle to get back to work because of these neurological symptoms, especially problems with concentration. So very scary stuff, actually, if you think about how many people the virus is infecting and how many people are recovering, but not necessarily back to 100%.
Yes. And Dr. Barnes actually told BizNews founder Alec Hogg in her interview with him that this is going to be a significant problem, particularly in rural areas and poorer communities. Many people will never be able to go back to work. And the big question mark is, who is going to look after all these people who will never recover fully from COVID-19?
Yeah. And again, it's this huge cost, and it's how do we spread it out? Because you wonder how much capacity do taxpayers have to absorb all these mounting social costs from COVID-19. It's an unexpected aspect of the pandemic that maybe we weren't thinking about when everyone was focused on lockdowns and maybe starting to sort of bring minds to bear on these deeper and more long-term problems.
Yes, and so we've also covered content produced by a think tank called Panda. Now, this is a group of actuaries, economists, and mathematicians, and they have been quite scathing about the forecasts by epidemiologists of the death projections, and they've looked at these forecasts in relation to the damage that is being done to the economy and how many jobs are being lost. And the underlying message is that the containment hasn't been an effective measure to stop the spread of COVID or limit long-term damage to the country, and that the economic losses have really outweighed the benefits. So there's been a lot of debate about whether these numbers are accurate or not, and also raising the issue of the responsibility of people who have statistics and use these to inform government policy. You know, there's a big responsibility on them to be very good at their jobs with this. And there's been some criticism now that we've been a little bit too loose and too enthusiastic about overestimating deaths. And this has really caused huge problems economically.
It's an interesting argument. And I think here's the thing, what I think about this, and the debate has come up in every country in the world. Were we too pessimistic in our projections? Could we have protected our economy? Why did we make the choices we did? And there's a few things to say here. First of all, we were operating with very limited information, and the epidemiologists who were doing the modeling acknowledged this and said in every model they created, look, this is a forecast based on best available data, most of which at that time came from Wuhan. It may or may not prove to be accurate in this context. Here's what we think might happen. And it was sort of up to policymakers to take those numbers and understand that they came with a grain of salt before, and to use that to inform their policy decision. So I think it's, you know, it's difficult to say epidemiologists messed up, because I think if you go and actually read the papers, if you go and actually read what they produced, and I've read a number of the academic papers and looked at their statistical models, they were as clear as day that this was a best guess. And if policymakers pick that up and presented it as gospel, then that's not really the fault of the epidemiologist who said, you know, take this comes with a warning label. And on the other hand, I also say you can't blame policymakers for acting out of an abundance of caution, because in the early days, again, we didn't know what things were going to look like. And any government that allowed the pandemic to run riot without taking any measures would have come in for very severe criticism, and we don't know what the consequences of that would have been. So it's very hard. It's easy to sort of criticize and say, oh, we should have done it differently. But at the time, governments were doing the best they can with the information available. And I also would point out that when the lockdowns happened, South Africans were hugely enthusiastic about it and thought that Ramaphosa was doing the right thing. So it's easy to sort of be critical in hindsight, but we've got to kind of keep in mind that when things are moving fast on the ground, everyone's just sort of making the best decisions they can. And then the final point I would make is Sweden is turning into a bit of a test case of this, because they didn't ever lock down. And so the argument that the economy would have been relatively unscathed without lockdown, we have a test case in Sweden to say, is that true? Sweden never locked down. They did advise social distancing, but there was no lockdown. And they have seen just as much of an economic hit as their neighbors that did lock down, as well as deaths that range from 6 to 10 times higher than their close neighbors. I'm talking about, you know, Norway, Denmark, Finland, and so on, the places that did lock down. So I don't know that there's a trade-off between you know, preventing the spread of the pandemic and the economy. I think the economy is always going to take a hit, but what you really want to do is get a hold of the pandemic so that it doesn't become a long-term problem that weighs down your economy for a year or two. Because countries that lock down early and effectively are starting to reopen and starting to see the rebound, whereas countries that have a pandemic running riot are in fact seeing the opposite and seeing the economies really suffer because people are scared to go outside. I think it's you have to consider what the real alternative choices were.
Yes, people feel very strongly about this. We had Andrew McPherson, who is an executive at Old Mutual, spoke to us this week, and he was one of the first people in South Africa who tested positive for COVID-19. And more than 3 months later, he still doesn't have a sense of smell. And he is wearing a mask, even though he's actually had COVID-19 when he goes out, because he says he wants to send a message to everybody that, you know, we should all behave in a responsible way and try and curb the spread of COVID-19. But he also thinks that an excessive lockdown is also not a good idea for the economy. And he also pointed out that when you look at the death rate, statistically, you still have a very low chance of dying from COVID-19. So lots of strong opinions from various quarters on this whole topic.
Absolutely. And I think it's the sort of thing that we don't really know because, you know, everyone's followed the policies they have, and we don't know what the impact would have been. So we don't know how South Africa's economy would be doing right now in the absence of lockdowns. It'll be interesting to see as we reopen. There's an expectation that we'll see this great economic rebound because people get out and start spending again. But I would say, speaking to friends and family in and around Johannesburg, some of whom have had COVID-19, there's a lot of fear and anxiety, and people are not keen to rush out and, leap into a crowd unmasked and see what happens. I think there's a lot of fear, and that is also going to act as a constraint on the economy going forward.
Indeed. Now, another big piece of news that we had this week is about the media sector, and we've seen more job losses, including, you know, one of South Africa's biggest media companies closing magazines like Men's Health and weekly newspapers and shifting online. And along with that, we also heard from FirstRand that they were lending some financial support to the South African National Editors Forum because they've seen that there are going to be so many job losses in the media, and this is actually not good for democracy because the media acts as a check against various powers and is accountable and tries to hold powerful people to account, in addition, of course, to the media being a vital cog in the economy. So that's a big area where lots of people have lost jobs, and that's an area that you've touched on in your worldview today, where you talk about how more people are going to have to find themselves freelance roles.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, it's a real cottage industry predicting the long-term impacts of COVID-19, and it's a bit of a sucking of thumb. But I do think that the world of work is going to have to change. The incentives are changing already for businesses who are starting to see that they can manage fine with people working from home. I'm sure you have spoken to a number of friends and colleagues who are working from home with no impact on productivity. And so there's a change in the mentality. And I think that companies looking to cut costs and to be more streamlined and to manage more efficiently in a very uncertain economic time are going to be much more receptive to the idea of hiring freelancers and hiring people who work remotely as needed. And I think that's it's going to accelerate what was a trend, but a fairly slow-moving trend. So I think that a lot of people are going to find that the next 10 years of work look very different from what they would have expected at the beginning of the year. But of course, in terms of the job losses in the media sector, it's difficult to replace publications and such like once they have gone to the wall. And I think that it's very unlikely that South Africa is going to get a new crop of magazines to replace the ones that are lost. So, you know, for someone who grew up buying her, you know, monthly copies of some of these things, it's a sad thing to see the end of print accelerating so dramatically.
And you also touched on another important aspect of this whole shift towards freelancing, which is that this could come at a cost to the government in terms of taxes.
Yeah, absolutely. My father never worked for a company. He was not that type of man. And always, every year was a huge drama and struggle around his taxes, because doing your taxes as a freelancer is just a bit more complex. The whole system is set up to work with big companies. And the whole basic assumption is that there's a registered employer who's going to pay you and collect your income taxes. And that's how it's going to work. So there's not really a lot of easy ways for government to track and monitor people who are freelancing or people who work for themselves or have these micro enterprises with maybe one employee, which is themselves. And so it becomes a much bigger job for governments to collect tax revenues that they are owed when instead of one big company, you have maybe 2,000 independent freelancers, many of whom, perhaps like my father, are not tax professionals and really struggle to navigate the complexity of the tax bureaucracy, even if they do want to pay their fair share of taxes. So there's a lot of complexity to shifting to that model of freelance versus traditional jobs. And it will be interesting to see how the South African Revenue Service responds to that type of change, in addition to their already long to-do list of other things that they need to be working on.
Yes, lots of food for thought, Felicity.
Thank you so much, Jackie, for making the time to chat with us today. You've been listening to The Editor's Desk here on BizNews Radio. If you'd like to read a summary of this podcast, there is one available on biznews.com. That's up in the premium section. Remember, you can sign up for premium. It's just £5 a month, and that's going to give you access to our unique premium content, as well as full digital access to the Wall Street Journal.